Yes, it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, and the phone lines are open.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. So if you have a Jewish-related question, then by all means, give us a call, 866-34-TRUTH. If you differ with me on interpretation of Scripture as a Jewish person, differ with me about faith in Jesus, Yeshua, by all means, give us a call. We'll catch up on some interesting Jewish world news. But I want to get into the scriptures with you first and give you a little principle about Bible study, and then share with you an interesting interaction I had, one of these providential moments. So when you see a particular phrase used over and again by a particular author or a number of biblical authors, you look at it to say, is this just here? Was just this one time that they used it a particular way, or are they using it in a set way over and over and over? For example, you'll see in the prophets by Yamim Haheim, in those days. Now, is that speaking specifically of a future time, the Messianic time, in those days, in the Messianic era? Or is it sometimes in the Messianic era? Sometimes you're saying, in these days I'm talking about, could be a year or 10 or 20 from now, whatever. So how do you know? Well, what you do is you isolate the phrase or the word, and then you search for it to see every time it's used by that author. So every time, say, Jeremiah uses it. And then more broadly, is it used in the same way throughout the prophetic literature? And does it have a specific set meaning? So it can be tedious, but you go through all the verses, and often you'll see patterns emerge. You'll see, oh, this is a set phrase. This does have special meaning. For example, the concept of the day of the Lord ultimately in the Bible comes to speak of the final day, the end day, the day of reckoning at the end of the age. But in biblical literature, it can also refer to seasons, times of God visiting in history. Like in Amos 5, woe to you who wait for the day of the Lord. It's going to be darkness for you and not light. They were not thinking so much about the end of the world, but a time of God's going to act on our behalf. It's like, yeah, when he does, he's going to judge you because you're in sin and idolatry. So there can be many days of the Lord in history and then the final day of the Lord. And you have to see, okay, what's what? Or did it initially have this meaning, and then once it became part of the Bible, have a larger future meaning? So you dig, you look, right? And it's often very rewarding. Many of you know I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the Hebrew root rapha, and I looked at every time it was used in the Hebrew Bible in nouns and in verbal forms, and then even in proper names. And then I looked at how it was used in the various Semitic languages, from Ugaritic to Arabic to Ethiopic to Akkadian to Syriac Aramaic. You know, does the root exist? How is it used, etc.? And very enlightening, very eye-opening. And, this is what this means. That's what happens as you dig in to the scriptures. So a few days back, it's late at night, and just about to fall asleep, but I decide, you know what? I want to start reading in the book of Isaiah in Hebrew before I go to sleep. And I'm in the very, very early stages of writing a commentary on the book of Isaiah. And I've been reading through Isaiah slowly in Hebrew, just thinking a lot as I'm reading. And maybe I should have been in chapter 6, 7, thereabouts. But for some reason, I decide, no. I'm going to start in chapter 4. It's like, why four? Why not three? Why not five? I don't know. And I'm struck by the phrase, by Yom HaHu, in that day. in that day. And I said, okay, let's just see how Isaiah uses this. Is Isaiah using this in a set way, meaning in that day, in the Messianic era, in the final day, in the day of blessing, the day of judgment, is that what he means? Or in that day, just the particular day I happen to be talking to you about? So for years, I used Bible Works software. They no longer are updating their software or making new additions. So I still haven't used it, but I've been using Accordant software a lot, which is wonderful and excellent, highly recommend it. And I've also had Logos software for years, which is also excellent, highly recommend. They're two totally different programs, and each one with different benefits. But I happen to be reading in Logos, and I've got the Hebrew text on one side, and then I click on any word in every lexicon, every Hebrew dictionary that I own on Logos linked on the left, and then different panels I can just pull up whatever I'm looking for. So I'm doing, you know, in-depth lexical study, dictionary study. So I decide to search for the phrase in that day and to see how many times Isaiah uses it. Does he use it as what you would call a terminus technicus? In other words, a technical term, meaning specifically in that day, the day of the Messianic era, the day when the Messianic kingdom is established on the earth. Or, because that's how it is in Isaiah 4, or is it just sometimes it means that, sometimes it means something else? So it's used a whole lot. I'm looking at the references, and then I'm looking to see how it's used in the rest of the prophetic books. Just looking at the references. How is this used? How is this used? And then, okay, I'm going to sleep. All right. Next morning, I get this email. Look at this. And I've just blotted everything out except for when it was sent to me. All right? And it's from someone in Israel. Michael, I will try to make this short, but it relates to a theological, eschatological discussion around Isaiah 19. And I have a question. In your opinion, I won't quote you on this, but is the phrase, Bayom Ahu, in that day, found all over the prophetic books, always and only meant to refer to the day of the Lord, so the final day? Could it also refer to the day when the or that specific prophetic word is fulfilled? I know you're busy, but would value your insight here. I thought, you got to be kidding me. That's the thing. Completely randomly, and this brother was going to be part of a symposium talking about some of these very issues. Out of the blue, I end up reading that, studying that, looking at that right before I fall asleep the night before. Completely random from my viewpoint, all right? And interestingly, where I had it on my screen, the top reference I had was the passage in Isaiah 19 in that day, the very one he's asking me about. So I wrote back later in the day, you will not believe this. Last night while studying Isaiah, and the last thing I did before going to sleep, I decided to study that very phrase in Isaiah and the prophets. Look at the screenshot. In short, I do not believe the phrase always refers to the final day of the Lord. It may refer to a day of the Lord, so a time of God acting decisively in history, and sometimes it refers to the final day, but no, not always the final day for sure. How providential. And then I sent him in my email the screenshot. So those that are watching, I want to put this up for you. This was what my computer looked like. This was on the screen. So on the right side was Isaiah 4:1, and seven women will take hold of one man in that day. And then next verse, in that day, the branch of the Lord will be for glory and honor. All right, and that's the messianic part. And then on the left, the search engine highlighting this in all the prophets, and it happens to have on top, because there's so many, I had to scroll down. I had left it with Isaiah 19, the very first he's asking me about. So he writes back to me, absolutely incredible, so encouraging, and yes, very providential. After I received your message, I sat stunned at the computer for some time. I love when the Lord does things like that. I absolutely love it. Not just the discovery of searching the scriptures, but when things happen providentially like that. When I was working on my doctoral dissertation, there was a book I was trying to get. It was actually a doctoral dissertation written by a professor in Germany, and it was focusing on the use of Rapha, the Hebrew root for heal, restore, in personal names in the ancient Near East. And I was really interested in it, but it was not in print. I had no way to get it. So I had written a letter. Now, this is, what, around 83, 84. I finished my dissertation at 85. So it's somewhere in there. So it's before emails, and it's before everything digital and so on. So I write a letter to the university. I don't know how massive the university is. I write a physical letter to the university, trying to get it to the right department, saying I'm trying to obtain this work from my own doctoral dissertation research. Any way you could let me know how I could get hold of it? And to my astonishment, so I mean that's months, right? To my astonishment, the day that I was about to start writing that chapter, where I dealt with that root in personal names, that day, I get this big envelope from Germany, from the university, with a copy. They Xeroxed every page and sent me the guy's dissertation. The day I was starting the chapter that dealt with that subject, the thing arrived. And I just remember just smiling like, Lord, that's really your hand just saying, yep, I got my hand on you for this. I remember one service I was going to be preaching from Psalm 112 at our home congregation. And during the worship, one of the leaders said to me, hey, Mike, do you mind if I get up and read from the scriptures here? And I said, no, that's fine. It fits around. Go ahead. And I knew he's going to read from Psalm 112. I just knew it. He had no idea what I was preaching on. I just knew he's going to read from it. He gets up to read from Psalm 112, and he knows I'm going to preach on that. Now, Psalm 112 is Psalm 112. It's truth. Everything written is true. It doesn't make it any more true. But I love these little providential things, and they've happened so many times over the years. But this was a recent one. So I thought, hey, give you a few tips of doing study, how to look at these subjects, but share a neat story with you. All right, we'll come back, get your calls, catch up with some important Jewish-related news. 866-348-7884.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is 30 Jewish Thursday. It's a good time to remind you of Paul's words in Romans 1:16, that the gospel is to the Jew first and also to the Gentiles, the power of God for salvation for all who believe. In Jesus, there is no caste system, class system. We are one in him. Jew is no better than Gentile. Gentile is no better than Jew. But there is a priority, a divine priority in bringing the gospel to the Jewish people. I want to invite you to partner with us. We are about to start producing a very, very important series of videos that will demolish some of the misinformation that's out there from counter-missionary rabbis and from those who are trying to tear down the truth of the gospel. We will be getting these out, God willing, starting to record next week, putting a lot of time and effort and energy into them. So stand with us. They're going to be very, very important tools for the whole body. They will help you share the good news of the Messiah with Jewish people. They themselves will be great tools to reach Jewish people with the truth, and they'll help a lot of Christians that are struggling with confusion. So stand with us on our Facebook page. Just click on the donate button on the S. Dr. Brown Facebook page. Gifts of any size are appreciated. Never think, well, I don't have much. Don't worry. Everyone does what they can. We'll do what we're able to do as well, and together we'll make that great difference. On YouTube, right beneath the chat window is a dollar sign. Click on that. And again, your gift of any size helps us. Or just go to the website, askdrbrown.org, and click on donate. I personally sign many letters that go out from our ministry thanking people for their donations. And I'll often add a scripture handwritten at the end, and often use Proverbs 11:25, that the one who refreshes others himself will be refreshed. So we know, as you sow into the gospel and sow into Jewish ministry, that the Lord will smile on you in many, many different ways. And then the greatest of all, treasure in heaven, lives eternally changed. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Zach in Honolulu. Welcome back to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
How are you?
Good, good.
Awesome. Cool. So, quick question. I was reading this book called Jewish Literacy, and there's this question that popped up in, it's a great book. One chapter, and it said, who is a Jew?
Mm-hmm.
So that is my question for you. Simple one.
Yeah, well, it's a simple question. It's a more complicated answer, but a very, very helpful book by Rabbi Joseph Telushkin. All of his books are excellent, Jewish Wisdom, Jewish Literacy, and other books that he's written. So one of the more popular Jewish thinkers of this generation. So a Jew would be someone who is physically descended from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the tribes of Israel, and continues to identify as a Jew, meaning that there are people who are physical descendants but have completely assimilated and have lost all touch with Jewish heritage centuries ago, so you have no idea who they are or where they are. So either someone who is a physical descendant or someone who converts into Judaism, and then thereafter their children would be considered Jews. So a physical descendant of the Jewish people through history, or someone that converts to Judaism and then would therefore be considered a Jew.
Okay. Can I ask you one more question?
Yeah. Now, how did Joseph Telushkin answer?
Well, he said that converts aren't really Jews because they're not, you know, like ethnically Jewish, as you and I are.
Are you sure he said they're not really Jewish? Did he use those words?
Well, here, let me just refer to it really, really quickly, if you don't mind.
Because in point of fact, according to Judaism, that if you're a convert, you can then immediately speak of the God of our fathers as if you are part of that historic group of people.
Yeah. Well, the way that I take it, Doctor, is that, it's kind of like if I were to move to China and, like, I would just call myself Chinese at that point.
But that's, Chinese is only an ethnicity. Chinese is only an ethnicity.
Right.
Being a Jew is also, but being a Jew can be ethnic or religious. Being a Jew is a practitioner of Judaism is another way it's defined. So,
Christianity is really the, may I ask this question?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, thanks. So since, I think that we both would agree that Christianity is really is the full and complete form of Judaism. So if somebody were to convert to Orthodox or to modern, Orthodox Judaism, would that really make them Jewish? Or just like adopt like a religious idea that just sort of guises Judaism?
Right, so here's the thing. I would not say it like that Christianity is the ultimate form of Judaism, because Judaism is a specific religion, and as it developed not believing in Jesus. So here, let me give you an example, okay? Can you tell me if the term Judaism exists anywhere in the Bible?
Not verbatim. Maybe some paraphrased version would use that, but not.
All right, so it usually. It actually literally occurs in Greek as Judaism, and Paul, in Galatians, the first chapter, he says, "I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people, so extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers." And he says, "For you have heard of my former life in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God violently and tried to destroy it." Acts 13 refers to devout converts to Judaism. So the point is there is something that was called Judaism that did not follow Jesus as the Messiah and that Paul was part of. So he was no longer practicing that Judaism, and that's the Judaism that has continued to define Jews through the ages. So if someone converted to Orthodox Judaism today, yeah, they are Jews in that same tradition of Judaism that Paul was once part of, a part that does not embrace Jesus as the Messiah. Now, you don't stop being a Jew when you follow him, but you're not practicing that Judaism. You may say we're practicing Messianic Judaism, you know, and that becomes controversial in the Jewish community, but you're not practicing that Judaism. So, yeah, if someone converted to Judaism today, that would make them a Jew in the eyes of the Jewish community and doesn't affect their salvation or their relationship with God. Obviously, that comes through the Messiah, but they would be defined as a Jew.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so referencing that chapter in Jewish literacy, there was a man, let's see, I think it was, let's see here, what's his name? Rufusine, Daniel Rufusine, who converted to Catholicism. And then I think by the law of return, he actually was regarded not as a Jew. So is it possible to, like, lose one's Jewishness?
Right, so that's the big debate. It remains a debate to this moment, Zach. There are folks that we know, part of a very, very famous case in Israel, that they were believers from South Africa, living very much as Jews who believed in Jesus, but very much living a Jewish lifestyle, making aliyah to Israel, and their son betrayed them. Their son turned them in and said they're not really Jews, and that ended up being a big case, went to the Supreme Court, and they ended up losing. So there remains debate about this. On the one hand, you could be a Jewish Buddhist, and no one questions whether you're still a Jew. You could be a Jewish atheist, and no one questions whether you're still a Jew. But what if you converted to Islam, say? Would you still be considered, would you be a Jewish Muslim? Convert to Catholicism would be a Jewish Catholic.
Right.
So that remains a debate in the Jewish community. There is a Talmudic text that says, even if Israel sins, he's still Israel. Meaning that no matter what a Jewish person would do, they're still a Jew. And when I came to faith and my dad was upset that I was getting baptized, you know, the rabbi said to him, don't worry, he's just a baptized Jew. And obviously don't take this too seriously either. And I've, you know, in debating with Rabbi Shmuley and all that, he'd say, yes, Mike, you're a Jew and fellow Jew. And other rabbis, counter-missionary rabbis that I deal with, interact with, they say, yeah, you're still a Jew. But others would say, no, you're not a Jew because you don't practice Judaism and you believe in things contrary to Judaism, namely Jesus being the Messiah and the deity of the Messiah and things like that. So it remains a debate. Basically, if you want to make aliyah, if you are a Messianic Jew, you want to make aliyah, you want to become a citizen in Israel, that God can open the door with you just being who you are and saying, this is who I am, and my mother was Jewish, here's the ketubah, here's the marriage certificate. You could do that, and God could open that door. But for the most part, it's best to not share other details of your faith, simply to say, I'm Jewish. I was bar mitzvah. Here's the ketubah from my mother. Here's whatever background, especially if you're living a Jewish lifestyle as a Messianic Jew. But when I said it's a simple question, but the answer is more complicated, I boil it down as simply as I could. But under the law of return, if you have a Jewish mother, you can return unless you convert it to another religion. So in that sense, you would no longer be considered a Jew. But it is a debate. Are you still a Jew who believes in Jesus, a Jew who believes in Allah, a Jew who believes in nothing? Or do you have to be practicing Judaism on some level to be a Jew? That's what's debated. Or you don't have to practice anything as long as you don't convert to something else. Then our argument is, hey, we're just going by the Bible. We're doing what every Jew should do. We're not telling you to stop being a Jew. We're telling you to be a Jew that's honoring God's Messiah. All right, we'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Go start talking to Jewish music here. I'm ready, poised, waiting, and well, we'll get it. We'll get it next time. We will. Welcome to the broadcast, Michael Brown. Delighted to be with you on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you have a Jewish related question for me of any kind, it's Hebrew related, Judaism related, Hebrew Bible, Jewish background to the New Testament, Messiahship of Jesus, Yeshua, by all means, give us a call, 866-348-7884. Okay, some headlines before we go back to the phones. Times of Israel reports that in the first half of 2020, that the UK has seen near-record anti-Semitism. Here's the headline. First half of 2020 sees near-record anti-Semitism in UK despite lockdown. In the survey, a British watchdog group Community Security Trust cites temporary drop in hate crimes coinciding with COVID-19 overall numbers and online bigotry rising. So you don't have as many physical attacks taking place. You don't have as many physical hate crimes because people are confined more. But you have rising online bigotry, online hatred. You say, well, that always happens to Jewish people. Yeah, well, you're going to hate somebody, Jews get hated on. That's the way it goes. But one of the reasons for the spike in anti-Semitism is conspiracy theories. Yeah, that's, and the article gets into that, that people are blaming the Jews for the virus. Friends, this has happened through history. I've given examples many, many times. I'm not going to do it again, but it's happened through history, be it the Black Plague, be it financial collapse in Germany, be it in the days of the Nazis, the Black Plague in medieval Europe, whatever it is, it's the Jews' fault. We are the ones that get scapegoated. You say, well, somebody's got to get scapegoated. Well, the Jews all the time. In my book, Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, I documented how late 80s, early 90s in Japan, when there is an economic fallout, economic crisis, that Jews got blamed. And there were best-selling Japanese authors explaining how the problems of the Japanese economy were due to Jews. Most of them never met a Jew. It's always the Jews, always. So no surprise there. And then double standards. Look, I want you to think of something for a minute. And I'm not playing the victim card here. I'm just pointing out when things happen. Let's point out and be honest. I think we've learned that in our society. When there's wrong, let's draw attention to it, okay? So I want you to think of this. You remember Curt Schilling, great baseball pitcher, Hall of Famer, Boston Red Sox, famous for his bloody sock victory. So with a foot bleeding, pitches against my New York Yankees, beats the Yankees, famous. Then becomes a sports commentator and opinionated, like many sports commentators are. Excellent insight about pitching and background and just very sharp. And he posts something on Facebook, and it's a man, very, very physically male man, dressed as a woman, basically saying, would you want this guy in your bathroom? And he was talking about extreme transgender activism. He gets fired from his job. Maybe one other comment, but it's fired from his job. Now you're getting people who are athletes, celebrities, icons, black anti-Semites who are attacking Jews, or they may not be anti-Semites historically, but they've imbibed a lot of the teaching of Louis Farrakhan, and they're putting it out there, and maybe an apology, and they're okay to go. And look, I'm all for someone says something stupid and they apologize, and okay, I forgive you. And now bring forth fruits worthy of repentance. Like, show us, right? If you're really sincere about this, show us. And that's great. We forgive. Hey, how many times do I have to be forgiven? By God and by people. So as one who's forgiven many times, I want to forgive others from the heart. From the heart, obviously. Especially when you see, okay, they seem to be sincere. They seem to be really taking steps to get more educated. Just like someone may, some white person may say something that's racially offensive. And wow, man, that was ugly. I have no idea how offensive that was. Hey, I want to learn. I want to fix this. I want to get this right. You know, and sit down with black friends or you know, read some books. Like, okay, I don't want to be, I don't want to be a jerk. I don't want to be insensitive. I want to fix this. You know, and whatever. Or I quoted this. I didn't even know what it meant. Thank you for educating me. So we humble ourselves, right? But it's amazing the lack of fallout and the lack of consequence in some of these cases. If you're hating on Jews, it's kind of okay. It's not great, but it's okay. Here, so check this out. Twitter. Twitter responds to MKs, those are parliamentarians in Israel. Twitter says that they will not remove the tweets of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. They will not remove his tweets because his tweets are not in violation of their policies. You say, what tweets? His tweets calling for the elimination of Israel. Yeah. Also Times of Israel. Twitter to MKs, so the parliamentarians, Knesset ministers. Unlike Trump tweets, gotta regulate Trump tweets and block them or warn about them, or right? Unlike those, Khamenei's Eliminate Israel posts are okay. That's what Twitter actually said. I tweeted out a question. Why is that okay? That doesn't violate hate speech. But if I quote dead name someone, so that would be referring to Bruce Jenner as he, so that's his quote dead name because he's no longer he, he's she. In the eyes of the world, if I refer to him intentionally as he, then that's dead name. I get banned from Twitter for doing that, theoretically. Misgendering. I get banned from Twitter. Blocked, disciplined. But you can post Eliminate Israel. That's just political rhetoric or whatever. What? And this is not the first time this has happened. The double standards are remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. 866-34-TRUTH. Let us go to Warren in Australia. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Oh, hi. Thanks, Dr. Brown. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Thank you, firstly, for coming to Brisbane back in February earlier this year.
Yes.
And thank you for your three-part message on grace as well.
My joy. My
and
joy.
Also, thank you for your
Rhema Church there. Yes. Yeah, that was my last trip. In fact, God willing, I'll be back out on the road again in August in numerous places in the States, etc. But that was my last trip. Everything got shut down after that. And I remember going through my flights. We got cancellations, had to get rerouted. There was 50 hours travel in each direction, crazily enough. And I had to spend hours and hours in the Hong Kong airport each way. So people then were wearing masks because it's Hong Kong, and they're already checking your temperature. Yeah, so it was just before everything shut down. So I'm so glad I made it there, and it was a wonderful conference Dave Pello put on and our host at Rhema Church. Great time. Thank you.
Yeah, and we're so glad that you came. My question for you is from Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 11, which is from this week's Parsha.
Mm-hmm.
So it says, you approached and stood at the mountain, at the foot of the mountain, and the mountain blazed with fire to the heart of heaven. I'm reading from the Complete Jewish Bible.
Yeah.
With darkness, clouds, and thick mist, then Adonai spoke to you out of the fire. So my question, which I haven't been able to find an answer for, is what do you know or what do you understand by to the heart of heaven?
Yeah, so Adlef HaShemayim in Hebrew. Shemayim can refer to the heavens, meaning, so heavens and earth can mean the whole universe, right? HaShemayim yeah. could refer to heaven in terms of God's heaven or just sky. And that's why, for example, the New Jewish Version, the mountain was ablaze with flames to the very skies. So I would not translate heart of heaven. I'm just looking. NET, I bet, has it. Yeah, ablaze to the sky above it. That's all it means.
Yeah, other versions have midst of heaven.
Yeah, so Lev is heart, could be midst, but... No, I the way NET has it and the way New Jewish Publication Society has it, that's the way I translate it. The flames went all the way up to the sky. So you got the mountain burning, but as far up as you can see, fire, smoke going up. That's how I understand the text. It's not up to...
And heart of heaven, so it's from the earth to
into the sky.
To the heart of heaven, to where God is, where...
No.
Where Adonai is speaking out of the fire. Is that what you mean?
No, just the fire went up into the sky. That's all. Lave can just mean in the midst.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So all it means is the mountain's burning, and it's not just localized fire, but this fire is so intense. It's as far up as you look, it's going up into the sky, into the midst of the sky. That's how I understand it. And God speaks out of that. Yeah, so it's not talking about heaven in terms of the heavenly throne or anything like that.
Fantastic.
Yep. Well, thank you for the question,
for
man.
Answer.
Yep, God bless you. If you're wondering when he said it, this week's parasha, parasha is the weekly portion of Scripture. So Jews around the world, joined by many Messianic Jews and some Christians as well, will read the same portion in the five books of Moses every week. So you read through once a year, and that cycle would then start again in the new year, so it's September, October. So now as we're coming into August, we're into the book of Deuteronomy, so that would be the cycle, the weekly reading cycle. And if you remember in Luke 4, that Yeshua takes the scroll of the prophet Isaiah and reads from it. You say, well, why Isaiah? Why not one of the five books of Moses? Because as far as we know, there were set portions that were read. So in Judea, they would read through the Torah in 1 year. So that would be the divisions broken down over the course of 1 year. And in Babylon, the cycle was over 3 years. So one was annual, the other was triennial. And ultimately, the one that took root in Judaism was the annual. And then that seemed to have been fixed in Jesus' day. Many scholars would argue for that. But there's a supplemental reading from the prophets, the Haftarah, the supplemental reading from the prophets. And that may not have been fixed at that time. It got fixed afterwards. That's why Yeshua could take the scroll and read from there. Hey, just want to thank Benjamin for your gift. Thank you for standing with us on Facebook. And Fun White and David, thank you for your gifts on YouTube. We appreciate it. It all makes a difference. You're helping us go to the Jew first. All right, we'll be right back. Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Whoever wishes, let him come. Whoever wishes, let him come.
Oh, yeah.
And take from the waters of life.
Marty Getz singing it out. Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. Hey, be sure to visit AskDrBrown.org and check out the many, many Jewish-related resources we have there for you. Ton of them. Really in-depth debates, articles, answers to questions, a Real Messiah website. So much there for you. Check it out. Check out the resources at AskDrBrown.org. All right, let's go over to Raleigh, North Carolina. Frank, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Shalom, Mishpocha.
Hey.
So good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you. Thanks.
I just wanted to find out if you are familiar with a book that is called... The Evangelist Calendar, that is the rendering from the Hebrew context of the book of Matthew, if you're familiar with this, and if you know anything about it.
Okay. All right. So if you're referring to the book by M.D. Golder, G-O-U-L-D-E-R,
yes,
the Evangelist
I
Calendar,
am.
A Lectionary Explanation of the Development of Scripture. So Golder's work, he's a respected scholar, and what he sought to do was to tie in the Gospels with various readings that would have been part of the Jewish calendar, etc. And it's and a lot of this is midrashic, you know, homiletical, etc. It's unique. He has not, let's just say it's been more his theory. And the moment you mentioned it, that's the name that came to mind. I would say he has interesting insights, but it's hard to buy into the whole theory. That it's saying a lot to buy into his full theory in terms of the layout of the Gospels being coordinated against the backdrop of the Jewish lectionary readings, the weekly readings or readings for holidays and things like that. But the positive is that he brings out, and he's obviously studied it in tons more depth than I have, it's his thing, but the positive is he brings out how much Jewish thinking is there in the Gospels and how much it ties back into the Hebrew Scriptures. That's positive. Now, there was something, perhaps it got confused when I was looking at my screen, a question about the Shem Tov of Matthew, which is a separate issue in terms of a translation of the Gospel of Matthew into Hebrew. Is it a translation into Hebrew or does it reflect the original Hebrew? George Howard has a book on it. Nehemiah Gordon's written about that a lot. But that's a separate issue from Golding, unless you were trying to bring the two together.
To be honest with you, sir, that I look at that as being I've lost you.
All right. I'm not sure if we dropped you out there, Frank, or if you were trying to gather your thoughts. But there is a full copy of the Book of Matthew in Hebrew. There are different copies over the years. From, 700 years ago? Don't have the exact date in my head. In fact, let's see if I can find that. In any case, the normal understanding was that this was, 14th century. So I was right, 600-700 years back, called Evan Bohan, the Touchstone. It was normally understood that this was a translation of Matthew from Greek into Hebrew. And it was used for counter-missionary purposes. In other words, to refute the missionaries and to have Matthew in the language that they could read, which was Hebrew, the rabbis, their communities could read and study and therefore be able to refute these missionaries. But others have said, no, there are aspects to it, plays on words and things that you wouldn't have if you were just translating it, you didn't agree with it and believe in it. Does it perhaps reflect the original Matthew? There are traditions that were preserved in the early church about Matthew originally being written in Hebrew. Does this preserve some of it or all of it? So most scholars don't believe that it preserves part of an original Hebrew Matthew, but some do. And George Howard be the best known in terms of scholarly work on it, and Nehemiah Gordon in terms of popularizing some of these issues. That's a separate issue, though, entirely. And one of the videos that we're going to be producing refuting some of the misinformation put out by counter-missionary Tovia Singer. We're going to touch on one of these. One of the first videos we're going to record is going to tie in with the question of a Hebrew Matthew. All right, let us go to Joseph in South Dakota. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi there, Mike, Dr. Brown.
Hey.
Hi there. I have a question about Rahab.
Yeah.
So Rahab, as we know, and is mentioned in the book of Joshua, and
yep,
she's the person who helped the spies in the with the wall of Jericho.
Mm-hmm.
But I have noticed throughout my reading throughout the Tanakh that Rahab is also mentioned as some type of country or some kind of enemy. Sometimes mentioned Rahab.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering, who are they referencing when they mention Rahab? Because I don't believe it's the same Rahab that helped the spies. So
yes, sir.
Where do we get this Rahab
from?
Yeah,
it's fascinating because you read, that's the name. You learn the name starting in Joshua 2. And she's mentioned a few other times in Joshua. I'm just looking at the references here. And then you get to Job 9, the helpers of Rahab, Rahav in Hebrew, and Job 26, by his power he stilled the sea, by his understanding he shattered Rahab. And then Psalm 87, I'll make mention of Rahab in Babylon. It's like, what? So there are three different usages for Rahab, Rahav in Hebrew. The first is the woman, this prostitute who feared Yahweh and cared for the spies and became part of Israel, actually part of the genealogy that leads us to the Messiah. So that's the one, the woman. Second is it's a name for Egypt. Why is debatable, but Psalm 87, when it refers to Rahab, that stands for Egypt. But elsewhere, where, for example, Isaiah 51:9, it mentions Rahav. So I'll read from the ESV, "Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not you who cut Rahab in pieces, who pierced the dragon?" And again, Psalm 89, "You crushed Rahab like a carcass. You scattered your enemies with your mighty arm." So who is Rahab there? Rahab stands for a chaos power, just like Satan is depicted as a dragon. Rahab is one of the chaos powers, the chaos monsters that God vanquished at creation. Another one is Leviathan. So Leviathan can refer to a physical being in the Bible, but also Leviathan refers to a demonic power. Isaiah 21, this twisting serpent that is smitten by the Lord. So that, again, how it develops is controversial. But for sure, Rahav stands for one of these chaos monsters, which is then associated with things like the sea. For example, in Canaanite religion, Yam, sea, was also the name for a deity. And when the Lord split the sea at the Exodus, that was a physical manifestation of what he had previously done in the past by destroying the chaos powers of darkness. And that's even part of Genesis 1 when God calls the seas together. So the dry land appears. God's saying, I have mastery over this. These powers of chaos and darkness and these unruly natural forces, boom, I speak the word and have power of them. But this reference to God chopping up Rahab, speaking A, of the demonic power, this chaos monster that God overcomes and destroys before creation or in the midst of creation, and then manifest in God's acts in nature when he splits the sea, etc. So three different Rahabs. Rahab the woman, Rahab standing for Egypt, and Rahab standing for a demonic power like Satan, a fallen demonic power that God vanquishes. Thank you, sir, for the call. You know what's interesting? Even in writing my Job commentary, even in writing that and dealing with the Rahab verses, in fact, let me see real quick. Do I have time? Yeah, I think I can grab this really quickly. I want to go to my Job translation to Job 26:12 and see how I rendered it. I just want to read it exactly for you. But what's interesting is when I did it, I didn't try to trace how the name Rahab came about. In other words, I know it exists, what I just explained to you. Okay, let's just see. Chapter 26. Can we get there together before we run out of time? Yeah, make it a little exciting here, right? And here's how I translated it. By his power, he stilled the sea, and by his understanding, he smote Rahab. But then I had a note saying it could be by his power, he stilled sea, capital S. In other words, this chaos monster, Yam, he destroyed him, and he smote Rahab. But how the names developed is another question. Speculation on that is interesting, but we'll have to wait another day to figure that out. All right, friends, keep praying for us as we go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel with the good news of Messiah. And thanks for standing with us. Together, we are making a difference. So visit the website, AskDrBrown.org. Check out our latest articles, videos, all the resources there waiting for you. And join us tomorrow. You've got questions, we've got answers.